Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. From a local business to a global corporation.
Partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Daily Tech News Show is powered by you. To find out more, head to dailytechnewsshow.com/support. Tech news for Monday, May 21st, or is it Tuesday, May 21st? Or by the time you're listening to this in Australia, it might be Wednesday, May 23rd. From Australia, I'm Tom Merritt. And joining me, very happy to have Peter Wells, reporter for The Age.
Hello, Tom. Good to have you here, mate.
Thank you for having me. Also, Raj Diyut, editor of Reckoner.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining me, man.
No problems. Thanks.
At a decent hour for all of us.
Very happy that it's a decent hour for a change.
It has actually just turned happy hour here.
We've
already got the beers out.
We do. It's a beer Friday on a Tuesday, which is some people's Monday and will soon be Wednesday. For those of you, I've decided now, I was thinking about this. There was a lot of confusion over when today's episode was going to come out because we're doing it afternoon Melbourne time. And afternoon Melbourne time is like midnight in Pacific time or 11 p.m. or something like that. You'll end up actually kind of getting two episodes on a Tuesday for those in the other hemisphere. Mm-hmm. That other hemisphere over there that we're not in, that now doesn't matter to me suddenly because I'm not in it. But it made me think a lot of people in the U.S. listen to Daily Tech News Show the next morning because it comes out in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, well, I'll just listen to it on the way in. I've noticed how it is definitely a morning show in Australia because it records about 4 a.m. So by the time you get up and get ready, it's the perfect morning show. So really we should be introducing DTNS with the next day's date or your days of date.
DTNS is like my morning riding to the train.
Yeah.
I ride to work on the train. Like, yeah, these are the headlines. Oh, these are the headlines I'm going to talk about today on Reckoner or somewhere else. It's a very informative service that I use, Tom.
Now, I'm sure Sarah and Roger will stop me, but I'm going to decide to always use Australian dates from now on.
Excellent.
That won't work. Welcome everybody to our roundtable show. It's a little bit different. Usually we do these on Fridays at the end of the month, but because I was going to be in Australia, the timing worked out for us to do it a little bit earlier. And it's the show we do once a month where we expand the regular show into a full-fledged roundtable discussion. We do a full hour of discussion while we cover all of the topics of the news of the day. In those discussions, we will still start with a few tech things you should know. Sources tell Reuters that the U.S. and China are near to a deal to remove the order banning the U.S. from supplying ZTE. That deal may involve China removing tariffs on agricultural goods from the U.S., but that might mean ZTE would unpause its business.
I don't know the format. Sorry, am I allowed to discuss a little bit?
Yeah, well, you can one or two lines, sure, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is actually a big deal for us as well because everything you do becomes a trade deal between us. And so ZTE is now no longer available here. And that's actually a lot of the phones that, say, your Telstra and your Optus sell unbranded are ZTE handsets. So I know a lot of people at Telstra particularly are scrambling over this news.
Yeah. Take the next one.
Intel and Microsoft disclosed Monday that a new method of exploiting the Spectre and Meltdown security flaw has been discovered. Intel calls it Variant 4, classified as a medium risk, and it has been seen in the wild, and a fix has been made available to manufacturers.
It is not.
It has not. That's an important typo there that I got out.
Facebook announced that its Project Terragraph, which aims to connect neighborhoods and businesses with gigabit wireless, will begin field trials in 2019 in Budapest and Kuala Lumpur. Terragraph is designed to replace fiber and cable broadband, not replace Wi-Fi. It's not like a home thing. It's a neighborhood thing. It uses 60 gigahertz technology from Qualcomm and 802.11ay, which is the successor of 802.11ad.
Just for the Aussies, we say Kuala Lumpur.
Kuala Lumpur?
Yeah.
All right. I'll do that. How do the people in Kuala Lumpur feel about that?
That's just how it is, Tom. All right.
All right. All right. I got it.
Microsoft launched SharePoint Spaces, a way to view company documents in mixed reality headsets, as well as a standard web browser. A new point-and-click interface makes it easy to build the experiences as well. Examples include a 360 video to familiarize employees with the campus, 3D product prototype demonstrations, and more exciting visualizations of Excel data.
Yeah, no, that was the best one right there.
I've been to a Microsoft event where they had the virtual room set up, and it was basically like walking around Tony Stark's apartment, but there were Excel spreadsheets on the wall, and I just thought, who would want this experience?
They had like a map with the data arising out of the regions, and it's very impressive. Google removed the main instance phrase, "Don't be evil," from its code of conduct sometime in late April or early May. The phrase has been Google's unofficial motto and part of the code of conduct since 2000, with a long description out of it saying, this is why you shouldn't be evil, this is what that means. Now, all the things about why you shouldn't be evil and what it means are still there. It's the phrase that disappeared. The phrase hasn't entirely been expunged, though. It is mentioned still in the final line of the code of conduct document. That line is, don't be evil, and if you see something that you think isn't right, speak up. So it's kind of just bad PR more than anything. I don't know why it disappeared.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, once you are known as the company that has "Don't Be Evil" in your code of conduct or whatever it was, in your motto, you can't take that away. There's no way you can take that away without everyone reading into that.
Yeah, I feel like it was a mistake that somebody who didn't realize edited the document or something. Weird.
Chinese regulators approved the sale of Toshiba's chip unit to Bain Capital. Toshiba Memory is the number two producer of NAND chips in the world. All antitrust approvals have now been received.
That's a big deal. China was holding up, and it was looking like they may not be able to sell that. It's a big deal for Toshiba because of Westinghouse bringing them down. So that's another significant move in the whole Chinese tariffs, international trade relations situation. Finally, the website finder.com.au says its survey shows the average amount spent on a mobile plan in Australia has declined from $48 a month to $44 a month. The drop is attributed to fewer people paying off the cost of their handset as part of a mobile bundle. 26% of Australians were on a mobile bundle this past year, down from 36% last year.
That makes total sense to me from the people I know. I think that, you know, the main bell curve, the main people in that bell are probably still just on a 2-year plan, and they upgrade when their 2-year plan ends. But I know a lot of people on the sides there, the kind of nerds who upgrade all the time, have totally gone prepaid and have moved to buying their own devices outright. And then on the other side of that spectrum, there are the people who are just holding on to their iPhone 6 or whatever it was because it's still a very good device, and they've taken that opportunity to drop down to a lower tariff.
Yeah, I do it with my mom where I send the phone that I've been using to her because I always buy it unlocked, and it gives me that flexibility. I don't have to worry about it being locked or unlocked or anything. It's always mine. I've paid it off because I buy it outright, and then I can buy a new one myself. And it's always fun to watch the accounts catch up as we move the SIM card. Mm-hmm. It'll be a couple months where it'll be like, we don't know what device you're on, and then they'll finally figure it out somehow. All right, let's start with our food. We've got two patron-suggested discussions that we're going to do today. The first was suggested by Alan Char. He asks, how deadly are the creatures in Australia, really? Then says, more seriously, in what ways does Australia's proximity to Asia affect Australian tech? On his first question, I've not yet been killed. I've been here a week and a half.
Yeah. We do have quite the selection of deadly sort of animals around. Where I grew up, we had great white sharks. There's also redback spiders and the brown snake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Brown snake, which are three of the most dangerous animals in the world. They're pretty prolific when it comes to the top 10 of deadliest animals. I grew up regularly having redback spiders in my woodshed.
Mm-hmm.
I tragically went to school with people that were taken by great white sharks outside.
Oh, wow.
Of
yeah.
So it isn't the most ridiculous concept.
I shouldn't laugh. Sorry.
I don't go in the ocean personally.
Well, we have great whites in California as well.
Yeah, but
yours seems like
they're not the right. They're not the same. Come on.
Somehow yours are worse.
Well, where I grew up is a migration point for great white sharks.
That makes sense.
A place called Port Lincoln. So it's they are very common there, and people travel from around the world specifically to go cage diving with great white sharks.
Wow.
So it's known as a point to go see them. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff around that'll kill you here, but it's not like they're walking down the street with you.
I haven't even seen a wombat.
Well,
the deadliest thing I've encountered was a magpie going off way too early in the morning.
Well, they will hurt you, magpies.
Yeah.
They swoop you. I've had cuts on my head as a child from them swooping. Or if you're a cyclist going to work during nesting season, they will savage you, a magpie.
Anyway, so come down. It's a great place to visit.
To visit? That's it for the Australian Tourism Board.
Yeah. Now, for the second part of the question. I think, sadly, I wish we were more integrated in Asia in terms of tech. I think there are many opportunities there that we're missing out on that is probably due to kind of a political thing, and not a specific political party or anything, but just a kind of a strange holdback of whatever is promoting that. I don't want to get too far into politics.
Well, it seems like you should have an influence because you're so close to China and Indonesia, but proximity in geography is not the same as proximity in trade relations or whatever. In the psychographic space, Australia is much closer to the United States and Europe, right?
Mm, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why one of the benefits that Asian companies see in Australia is that there are quite a few Asian companies that will use Australia as a kind of test bed for their products and also to test kind of how their marketing message works in a Western market, because, you know, we're a very small market, so you can make mistakes here and it doesn't really impact too much. But even though we're a small market, we're a very, you know, highly developed market. We buy a lot of tech. We're very early adopters. According to all of the studies we see, you know, we tend to buy phones faster than anyone else in the world, and we tend to
even as expensive as they are, yeah.
We do love our tech down here. So we become, I think, a very good A/B testing market for those kind of things as well. So you see brands like Huawei and Oppo kind of trying here first, and then whatever works here kind of gets exported out. And they'll even do it. So Oppo, for instance, will do, you know, they did a whole marketing campaign based around a European football team here. Then they, once it worked here, they took it to that team's region. So yeah, it's a really interesting
testbed.
Just because there are so many expats and stuff
right.
that live in Australia,
there are enough people
worked.
Following it that they're like, oh, I'm interested.
Yeah. exactly. So it's that kind of stuff. I don't know, Raj.
Yeah, it's also a frustrating dichotomy being so geographically close to Asia, because we quite often see the Australian tax on things. We're so close. We do have really good trade relations with China, especially for our uranium and things like that. But it often means that even though, you know, you buy a custom to order Mac, for example, it gets built and created in Asia and shipped out from that. But you are effectively paying the US price converted plus a little extra. Mm. And it is quite frustrating from a consumer standpoint being here and being so close that we are paying extra on top of what the regular conversion might be, because the products are built and the shipping arrangements are catered for US companies, not for Australia.
Yeah, and Sydney's closer to Shenzhen than LA, but yeah, we still pay more.
That I was talking with somebody about that earlier this week, and how we were trying to figure out why that is. Because, yeah, theoretically, it should be much cheaper to ship something here, because you can just write down the, you know, little – I guess it's farther south than it looks on the globe, but it's still closer than LA, right?
Well, Perth, which is the most isolated capital city in the world, is actually closer to Singapore than any Australian capital city.
Yeah.
So why? why
Perth should have the cheapest Singapore electronics.
You should be able to buy anywhere outside of Singapore for pennies in Perth, but you can't.
Well, is that and I think you mentioned that, but it's because all of the it's the economy of scale, right? Mm. They're set up to send everything to North America or Europe, and you just don't have as much demand because of the population in Australia is not as large. Is that why?
I think it's also just a company like Apple famously will build everything around the US market. So it'll be the marketing is built around the US market, but also the pricing. And so, a company like Apple will price the iPad in US dollars, and then whatever that price is, products can fluctuate so much in this country based on how well the Australian dollar is doing, and not actually how it's doing at the time, but how Apple's accountants think, project it will
be doing. Or trying to kind of steer against that.
So, one year the iPad might be $460, the next year it might be $520, based on just what they see in the markets moving.
Yeah. Well, and Europe is kind of your control factor there, because even though they build around the US market, they do it's not as expensive in Europe as it is in Australia, relatively speaking. It doesn't seem like it is. But then when Brexit happened, you saw them start to do the same steering with the pound because there was more volatility there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all kind of balances out. We do pay our general take-home pay is actually quite high when you look at it that way. So, we do pay. A lot of that would be coming in as tax as well. Some of the kind of Australia tax that you see is actual Australia tax.
Yeah, right.
We make it up in the fact that our wages are probably a little bit higher.
There's no New Zealand headquarters that they can get around.
No. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we'll move on to our second patron-suggested topic. This is from Mike Weissman, who asks, could you discuss how Australians view net neutrality and how does their government regulate the internet? Now, I'm very curious to hear what you guys think of the whole net neutrality debate in the US, but then I think it gives us a nice window to talk about MBD and Telstra and how things have differed here in general too.
Yeah, well, our government sort of has a take on net neutrality by enforcing a terrible network that the Australian people have to use.
Yes, exactly. It gives us a doorway right there, doesn't it?
Straight into it. The NBN, look, that's not true. Net neutrality.
Or NBN, MBD.
National Broadband Network, which is a government-funded infrastructure scheme to allow, originally to put fibre to everyone's home. Every home in Australia would have a fibre connection. That's then changed over the years with the change of government. Anyway, talked about that a lot on many, many Australian podcasts. But net neutrality is a different one. I guess we see it from afar, and we see what's happening in the US, and it is quite scary in terms of the change, because a lot of Australian policy and a lot of Australian infrastructure is decided or influenced on by what happens in the US. And if that is net neutrality in the US, then there's a very good chance that it's going to be rolled out over here. We're seeing different things around mandatory metadata collection by internet providers in Australia as a security implementation that the government has enforced now, and doing a whole sort of range of different things, very, very much bordering on the net neutrality sense. So I wouldn't be surprised if we start hearing sort of rumblings or talkings of it in the next 5 years or so, that's the way that it will go if it eventuates in the US. But we don't really know how it's – well, I don't really know how it's going to affect us in terms of accessing US services from here as well. Like, does that mean that our wholesale partners that have Pacific cables that go across to the US will be pulling down data because the endpoint on the West Coast has agreements with the bigger providers? Or does that mean that they retain that sort of even playing field and everything's just piped out at the same speed? Like, that sort of stuff hasn't really been conveyed, and the general Australian public, I don't think, even knows what net neutrality is. And it's also a confusing talk point from, is net neutrality a good thing or a bad thing? People just hear the words net neutrality. They don't know, like, sometimes the word neutrality is a bit obfuscated in a way that it doesn't really stand out that, no, net neutrality is kind of what you want. You want this even playing field, but people just sort of see a headline or don't really understand it. So I don't think we're generally educated in it over here. A lot of us technically inclined people are, but it's all a bit of a wait and see type of situation for us, and hopefully it doesn't come out in the US.
Well, I think, you know,
the loss of it.
We without getting too far down the rabbit hole of net neutrality again, because there are so many different opinions on it, and we've done shows about it before. But the upshot is, if you have enough competition in markets that do, net neutrality is often not a problem. So in Korea, for instance, the government has taken the role of fostering competition, of making it easy for multiple fiber operators to run fiber into a particular building. And net neutrality isn't a concern then, because anybody who changes how they manage traffic risks losing customers if they do it in a way the customers don't like, right? And then we see other systems like in England where they've done, you know, open loop bundles saying, you know, all we're going to do is say if you build the network, you have to open it to competition. In the U.S., what's happening is they're saying we don't want regulation, but we also don't want to foster competition. Mm. So you're kind of getting the worst of both worlds. What's it like in Australia with the National Broadband Network? It's not the only option for people, mm-hmm. and it's kind of government-run, but not.
Well, it's supposed to be the government-run side of things. It's supposed to be the pipes, the backhaul, and, you know, that then a retailer or a reseller would then sell you the internet package over those.
So the
pipes.
Government lays the cables, exactly. And then says, we'll charge you to get access, and then you build your business on it.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And, you know, I think net neutrality, first of all, as, you know, as Raj said, it's a terrible term. It needs better marketing. It has done for years. But, I don't think it's ever really kind of grabbed the attention of Australians as it should have. And I think part of that is because there really has never been really net neutrality in this country anyway, which is really sad. Like in the sense of, where I've just moved into, I only have the option of ADSL. There is no higher, there is no cable. I finally did find a wireless internet provider, which is a whole other story.
But you don't have fiber.
We don't have fiber. We don't have just even HFC coaxial.
Is it supposed to come to your neighborhood someday?
When we moved in, it was supposed to come in March, and now it's, I think, June next year. It's just one of those things. So I know when I hear Americans on various shows talking about, well, I've only got the one choice in my area, what they mean is I only have the one choice of cable in my area. We don't normally even have the choice of cable. We have ADSL or nothing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that has kind of, you know, has blunted the argument a little bit anyway. It's like, well, my internet sucks. Like, who cares? Yeah. Like, you know, how could they make it any worse? You know, so it's like that scene in Life of Brian, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's a strange situation. And then on the other side, we have, like, on the mobile devices, we have really, really strong competition. But we have those, like, people have just accepted a lot of the zero rating stuff that I know, say, Patrick Bajor has issues with. So, for instance, if you're on Telstra, you get the AFL for free. If you're on Optus, you get soccer, the Premier League for free. If you're on Vodafone, you get Netflix for free.
Now, is this on your wired there. Or on your wireless?
Wireless.
Wireless,
yeah,
okay.
Cell phones
we have stuff, similar things like Verizon will give you the NFL if you're on, stuff like that. So, okay.
So, it's a weird one. I mean, so where do you sit with that? Do you feel comfortable
with
about
the pay priority, the zero rating thing?
Yeah, which is it's a different thing.
It's like
slightly,
it's funny because like in India, Facebook ran into like stiff opposition to zero rating. In India, they're like, no, zero rating is a violation of net neutrality, and the general populace will not allow it. And they had to pull out of India with their free basics, because the idea of free basics was without charging you data, we'll give you access to Wikipedia, BBC News, Facebook, etc. And in India, they said that is choosing what information we get. Mm-hmm. And Facebook's argument was like, yeah, but it's free. And the idea isn't to control messages. The idea is to give you a little bit of the internet so that when you start to see the value of it, or maybe it'll help you build a business or whatever, or get a job, then you'll be able to afford to pay for full internet. And the idea was never to keep people on free basics, but to move them into paid. In Africa, that's worked great. In Africa, people love that. They're like, yes, this is awesome. We get some free internet, and when I can afford it, I'll upgrade. So I don't think there is a moral absolute on zero rating. Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with how it's implemented. And again, I've been pounding this drum for 10 years now, but my whole response to net neutrality is if you have effective competition, it's irrelevant. Mm. The best way to make sure there's net neutrality is to make sure people have a choice. And if somebody says, hey, we're going to, you know, prioritize our own movie system and Netflix is going to be slow, so you should switch to ours, people will just get rid of that internet service provider and go to the one that gives you Netflix. Mm. Comcast, the few times that they have violated net neutrality in the United States, bowed down to public pressure. And still without saying, well, it wasn't a violation. We weren't snooping for BitTorrent packets, but just that much made them bow out. Imagine if they could actually switch to something viable. Yeah. So to me, zero rating is like, well, I think it's fine if you have a balanced playing field where people can decide, yeah, I don't like that zero rating thing. But I don't like that if it's unchecked, it does allow the carriers to start to pick winners and losers. And the whole beauty of the internet was that anybody could access it and start something.
And I think, the best way to look at that is to actually even go further up and say it's not just about net neutrality when it comes to competition. That's how capitalism works. Like, capitalism is fine system. I'll go for fine because it's an American show. capitalism is a fine system when there is competition. But when there is not a natural competition in place, then you need regulations or you need something to balance it out. Because we've seen in markets where someone holds a very large part of the market, they're less likely to improve. They're less likely to worry about losing customers because they don't have that worry.
And I look at my view on net neutrality as almost populist, too, because I'm not focused on what's good for companies. I don't care what's good for companies in this particular argument. I care what's good for me. And what's good for me is having choices that I can punish the one who does something I don't like, right?
Yeah. And that's why I really appreciate our phone networks here, at least in terms of the cellular side of things. I've switched phone companies all the time. Like, I'm not loyal to my companies at all. If someone's offering a better deal, I'm happy to walk away. And because our system makes it so easy to just immediately port your number and 2 hours later, all of your, your phone is working again, it's back online. And there's no, I never get a ding for breaking a contract or anything else. That makes them work really hard to keep me. And
it makes a difference.
The only other thing I'll add is that really with the NBN, going back to Australia and that, we should have the most net neutral country in the world. If we've got an infrastructure,
theoretically,
that is controlled by the government, it is provided by the government, provides an equal playing field for every internet provider in the country who wants to operate in the country. It's the same pricing, the same infrastructure, the same delivery network. We should have the most neutral network in the world. But it's being thrown out of proportion and whack because of the ridiculous pricing that they have on the wholesaling. It's coming in, it's being fixed, but very slowly and poorly. And then the constant change to technology requirements or the multi-technology mix that the government's that's putting into place because one said they could do it cheaper than the other and they got elected and it all changed and all upheaval. So, but theoretically, the original promise of the National Broadband Network and fibre to every home in Australia, except for a very small portion of rural, regional Australia, which cannot in any way, in shape or fashion, have fibre, should have provided the most net neutral network in the world. Sadly, that's not the case.
Well, and the reason is it's hard to have a neutral network when there's one person in charge of it, right? And in this case, the one person was the government. Mm. But the government, it wasn't a violation of net neutrality the way we think of, which is, oh, Telstra decided to downgrade Netflix so that, you know, they could push their own video, or Foxtel got in and published their video ahead. That's usually what people think of, is like, oh, you'll slow down the competition. But what happened here was just a different sort of like, well, we're in charge, so we're not going to do all the things that need to be done to create an effective network. And not even because they necessarily wanted to do it that way, but because of politics, meaning the person who started the project was not the person who carried it on, and then they changed their mind. And And so there is a danger to having one entity running it. Which is actually why Korea, I go back to Korea all the time, and I know people say, well, Korea's smaller. It's like, well, great, then do it in Massachusetts or do it just in Melbourne. Like, do it in a small region. But that way of saying the government's job is to make it easy to start an ISP. and easy to implement it and run it and provide the right of way and all of that and then get out of it and let people do it.
Actually, that's why everyone's moving to Hobart, because it was one of the first places that got the NBN, and it is a beautiful city. It's very small and it is fiber everywhere. It's a paradise.
But that's on Tasmania?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and also amazing whiskey.
Yeah? Huh. I always identify Hobart with the big dishwashing machine we had at college, because it was a Hobart dishwashing machine. I don't know if that's any connection, though. Probably not. But that's what I think of, as a huge dishwashing machine. And now I have a much better image for the word Hobart, which is a beauteous land of flowing broadband. And whiskey. Yeah, you got me. Maybe I should just move to Hobart and do the show from there.
I'm thinking about it, man.
It sounds quite enticing. How many things kill you in Hobart?
Nothing. Yeah, it's way too cold. All of the stuff that'll kill you.
The Tasmanian devils aren't that devilish. Extinct, yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, sadly. So.
Do they have snakes?
Look, we'll talk about snakes later.
The Tasmanian Tourist Board is getting up here. We'll talk about snakes later. All right. Anything else on this topic before we move on?
No, it's fine, I think.
All right, let's talk, Raj, about what you were wanting to bring up. What's your topic for the round?
I'm just going to steal the mic away from
you. Yeah, sure, completely. Sure.
I was just going to talk about E3. It's coming up. We're a little under 3 weeks away. I'm heading over to the wondrous land of the home.
Home of the free.
Home of the free.
And the
land of the brave.
Land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yeah, that one. I'm heading over there. That's where you're from, Tom. Mm. To Los Angeles for the Electronic something.
Entertainment Expo. Expo.
Thank you. I should know that. This is my fifth year or something there. It's turning into a bit of a carnival, I think, E3. It opened up for the public last year.
Yeah.
Changed significantly with that move. There's only a limited number of spots, but it's definitely changed the way that the expo runs. Second year round running, they've sold out, obviously, of all those tickets, which I think were around $250 US a pop. So not that cheap. But then if you weren't media or invited anyway, it was about $1,000 to go. It's this weird sort of game with E3 now, of the companies trying to almost beat it in a way, to run their own show independent of it, make the announcements leading up to it. We've had announcements from EA, from Activision, from Nintendo, all well ahead of E3. And really control their own message, in a similar way to Apple's been doing for years, where they can have their own show and run their own game away from the big conventions, they can really sort of stamp their own ground.
Well, and Sony is not going to do anything but show off a limited number of games this year. No hardware announcements.
Yeah,
right?
Well, to be fair, Sony have got so much of the market right now, they could basically not show up.
Yeah.
And then they run their own sort of PlayStation experience events. They run one in the Northern Hemisphere, or two in the Northern Hemisphere, actually. So they're really running their own gambit in their own way as well. They just sort of figure, well, we may as well show up. They're probably booked ahead for the next 3 years anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the most recent announcements coming up leading up to E3 was Activision with a very popular Call of Duty franchise, which gets a release every year. It switches back and forth between one development house and another, so they're on a two-year cycle of each of them. But this year's is jumping on the wonderful train of battle royale games. So your Fortnites, your PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds, your H1Z1 before all the others, with the new Blackout battle royale campaign. Well, they don't really, they haven't given many details other than to say that that's the name of it and it's coming. Their announcement was literally to turn off the lights at the event because it was a blackout. So interesting.
Clever.
Yeah, interesting way of doing it. Obviously, Fortnite is this huge phenomenon at the moment. I was at a baptism on the weekend, and every parent there was talking about how their kids are addicted to Fortnite.
It's that generation's Minecraft, right?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Minecraft kids have grown up now.
That's
They're
right.
Starting to go to college.
And every single parent I talked to was saying, oh, well, you know, I can't get them off this thing. I said, well, this is just this generation's Minecraft.
Like, yeah.
5 years ago, it was exactly the same thing with Minecraft. the argument was, well, Minecraft didn't have them running around shooting things. Well, it kind of did. It depends how they played it. So, but anyway, so the new Call of Duty is coming out with the version of Battle Royale. And we're seeing more and more of Battle Royale clones coming out, more and more multiplayer. The new Call of Duty has no single-player campaign whatsoever. It's purely focused on multiplayer, zombie maps, the normal Call of Duty stuff, the Battle Royale mode that's being introduced.
Well, Battle Royale, I mean, Fortnite, I'm sorry, Epic Games itself announced that they're going to sink $100 million into Fortnite esports competitions.
Yeah.
It feels like that is an important thing for new games to have, is an esports strategy.
Definitely.
Like how it can be used for esports now.
Yeah,
and Blizzard was part of that with Overwatch, but that's been a growing trend.
Yeah, well, esports is obviously one of the biggest and fastest growing markets in the world right now. Like we're seeing real world, you know, sports like in Australia, Fox Sports is covering esports. We've got bookmakers like Gfinity's run out of the UK focusing on esports. You cannot release a big AAA game these days without having an esports sort of element to it, or the potential for one to have. But because of all this, because of things like esports, because of things like Battle Royale and the money that these things are making, we are seeing less effort and less story-driven titles come out. There was God of War, which recently came out, was one of was critically acclaimed, and my review of that is still forthcoming. It's coming, I promise. I finished writing it yesterday. It's one of the few.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Things, we're seeing less and less of these story-driven things and more of the multiplayer experience, because they're the ones making money. They're the ones that are capturing people. They're the ones that have the longevity of and they can keep adding seasons or colors or skins or loot boxes and all these different things. And sadly, it's at the detriment of storytelling.
Yeah.
And I, for one, want the storytelling. It's hard to sell a game, though, at US $60 or $109 or whatever it is here, that doesn't have that longevity anymore, because these are free-to-play games like Fortnite. So what do you do? Like, how are we going to lose this? Is it going to be gone forever? Do we have to rely on indie games? Like, it's quite sad to see this sort of tilt shifting, and games like God of War or Horizon Zero Dawn last year, or The Last of Us, which is probably another massive one from Sony that's coming out, but that will have multiplayer. Like, where do we see this going? Like, I don't want to see the death of single-player or campaign-driven games.
I mean, generally, the history of gaming is the trend is started by something successful, and it's just like movies, right? And so everybody starts making the vampire movie. Everybody starts making the first-person shooter or the multi – the MMORPG, or now it's the PUBG bandwagon. But it doesn't kill the other types of games. What it does is it forces someone – sometimes indie, sometimes not – in my opinion anyway, to jump in and say, you know, we're going to do this other style really good and we're going to do this really well. And you get things like The Last of Us. You get these very creative takes on it. So I don't think it's the death of single player. I think what it is the valley, right? We're going to have to go through this valley of all the game companies putting all their intention on Battlegrounds and esports. Until somebody pops up and says, well, hey, wait a minute, you know, I can do this. It kind of relates to the net neutrality conversation, right? It would be a problem if all you had was EA. And it's like, and now they're just doing Battlegrounds, and it'd be like, great, well, now nobody. But because we have so many different gaming companies, it may take a little while for it to shake out, but we'll get something else. That's my feeling anyway.
Yeah, and it's you know, if you look at that the movie kind of analogy, you know, the cinema goes through these periods as well. Every couple of years you hear that cinema is dead, and the adult contemporary movie is dead, and no one's going to see those kind of films. And then a Lady Bird comes out, and everyone goes and sees it.
Yeah,
you know? So you're waiting for the gaming equivalent of Lady Bird to come out, but we've still got like four more Marvel Universe
Lady
movies.
Bird the video game. Maybe that's it.
No, first person Lady Bird. Yeah, it'll be fantastic. But so I mean, I'm totally with you. Like, I think one of the worst things to happen to Rockstar was GTA 5, and the fact that it made more money last year than any other entertainment franchise on the planet. It made more money than Marvel for a game that came out 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's still just making money on online, and the online experience is awful. I can't stand it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, Rockstar used to be that publisher that I would wait, and I would go to midnight launches of their games because I couldn't wait to play the next story. And even GTA 5 story was pretty kind of crap. But I think that's one of those really interesting things where you see, like, I saw my Twitter, at least my Twitter that I follow, go nuts when the Red Dead Redemption trailer came out, because it was like, oh my god, a story, finally another story. Like, you know, there are ones that come out like Far Cry have never been good at telling stories. Like, they've had good characters, but they've never actually held it together in a narrative, whereas I'm totally with you. I really love those experiences, like a Last of Us, like the original Red Dead. I cried at the end of the original Red Dead. I couldn't believe it.
Well, both of those, I've heard people say that, you know, they were such moving stories that they teared up about. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Red Dead Redemption 2, fingers crossed, will be amazing. But I think the sentiment that I am getting from some of these single-player campaigns, like, again, God of War, because it's recent and relevant, but it felt padded out. It felt like it did have an amazing story. It's a father and a son connecting and bonding through, you know, absence and the death of the mother and wife and so forth. And it is this beautiful, amazing graphical adventure with all this stuff, but there's so much shoved in, just fat, to lengthen it so it can compete for screen time with these other titles and, you know, multiplayer games and things like that. It felt too long.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have gladly paid, you know, the full price, the sticker price, for something that was almost half the length of what it was without all this extra filler, because it now needs that type of stuff to compete against all of these other sort of genres and titles and non-story-driven things. I also get that I'm older now. Mm-hmm. So your tastes and your wants and different things change.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like the story part versus, you know, my friends' 8-year-olds or only want to go home and play, watch someone play Fortnite or play Fortnite because they can play it and it's ongoing.
Do you think there needs to be like a Cannes Film Festival Sundance for video games?
BAFTA kind of does.
Yeah.
They try to elevate games that and they don't actually give out awards every year, but every time a game deserves an award, the BAFTA critics will give them one. So yeah, they've given, say, Journey and The Last of Us and a couple of other titles.
Because I was thinking about Lady Bird, and the reason Lady Birds get made is they know they can play the festival circuit. They can hit Sundance, they can hit Toronto, maybe they can hit Cannes and others. And then they'll be able to find a distributor. They'll be able to go out into the landmark cinemas in the U.S., and I'm sure there's equivalents in other countries where they will play the art house film. So they know they'll get a return, and maybe it'll shoot up through the ceiling. I don't know that video games have quite the infrastructure for indie games like that yet.
I don't know. I mean, Steam, Steam has things like the Stanley Parable and little games like that that, there's no way that that game could ever afford to start on an Xbox. It might be ported later, but it has to start on a PC. It has to start as an indie and then kind of go from there. And hopefully we'll see some of that stuff on the Switch as well, because I think that would be great. But, I mean, there are your indies like that. Well, what was the Firewatch is the other one everyone loves. So there are those kind of – is that the Lady Bird video
Maybe.
Game that we're thinking
of? Is Firewatch the Lady Bird of video games?
It's not too far off. Well, a lot of people call it a walking simulator because you literally just walk around and follow a story. So there's not much more to it. But they've got a very exciting new game coming up called In the Valley of Gods by the same people, which looks really interesting, exploring Egyptian tombs and so forth back in like the mummy era.
I guess what I'm doing is I'm putting together the fact that E3, as much as you're preparing for, you kind of know what you're going to get.
Oh, definitely. You know ahead of schedule what the big ticket items are. There's probably one or two potential sort of big reveals, but a lot of them are leaked. Like Walmart Canada leaked one of the massive reveals from Bethesda with Rage 2 coming out. So, all of this stuff, whether it was leaked on purpose or leaked by accident, it's sort of it stammers out beforehand so they can control their own message and get it out there and build that buzz. And E3 turns into not a press coverage event, but an opportunity for people to go and play games.
Well, I mean, to be fair, that's what Cannes has been for the last, 30 years. So I guess that really has become...
morphed. In my head, E3 is CinemaCon, which is in Las Vegas. You never hear much about it because it's the movie studios coming out to the theater owners and saying, this is when Superman will come. This is when Spider-Man will come. Like, these are all the big things. And I don't know that there's a Sundance of video games where you can be surprised and you don't know quite what's out there. Maybe you don't need it. Maybe Steam is, that's a good point. You kind of don't need a distributor deal when you can just put it out on Steam.
I'd say things like PAX. A kind of like
that's
you,
a really
sort of
PAX
sort
is
of
a bit that you're right
like
you're right
you look at the games that were involved in Indie Game the Movie, like Super Meat Boy and Braid Fez.
Even GDC has a little bit of that flavor too.
One that comes straight to mind is a title called the Dragon Cancer or that Cancer Dragon, which was a game that a father made for his daughter who had cancer at a very young age and sadly passed away, and that was his way of dealing with it. There was a documentary made about that, which I originally saw at the Melbourne Film Festival, which led me to the game. But that little circuit of shows like PAX, where they showcase upcoming or PAX Rising is the name they give them, titles, is a way for a lot of indie developers to get out on the
All
scene
right.
and
PAX is the Sundance of video games. I think you've figured it out. Anything else before we move along to the next one?
See you in LA.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Right. Let's finish up with Peter's discussion topic. What do you got for us?
I was just really interested in seeing the Google I/O announcements, specifically the Digital Wellbeing Initiative. And this was something I wrote about at the start of the year, actually, about trying to kind of disconnect a little bit more from the phone. And I know I'm not unique in writing that. I know a lot of people have kind of come to that idea that something has to be done about how much we kind of devote to the tiny little glass in our life.
The Black Mirror.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I know. And I don't want to get, I know some people can take it.
Man, I saw some ABC News, Australia Broadcasting Company news promos of technology, it promised so much, but it's ruining. Like, that is the hot way to pitch that story now. Mm. But there is a reality behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like what I saw from Google. I think that they're doing, all of the stuff that they showed about kind of telling you when you had spent maybe too much time on your phone and gently asking you if you really want to continue or, draining all of the color out of your screen if you had been been on your phone after a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
Are just really nice, subtle, and also kind of playful ways of saying, like, hey, not judging, buddy, but, you know, maybe get outside. And it's really, I find it really frustrating as an iOS user that you can already kind of get stuff in the Play Store that can, because of the way Google has written Android, that can kind of take over your phone and really force you off the phone if you want that. To be there.
With your permission.
With your permission, exactly.
I mean, there's also malware that does that, but that usually gets kicked out of the place.
Or it pretends to be Facebook. But, whereas in iOS, of course, you know, that third-party app developers don't have that that power over the operating system. So we're relying on Apple to actually build some of this stuff into the system. And I find it really interesting, actually, now that I've actually started giving my 2.5-year-old an iPad, really gently introducing an iPad to her. Like, we've been, you know, showing it to her for just a couple of minutes at a time,
mm-hmm.
and she can't watch any videos on it. It has to always be an active engagement. Mm-hmm. It has to be she's playing with something or whatever. She can't just sit down and watch
some kind of game or
hours,
educational
yeah.
thing. Or,
exactly,
yeah, yeah.
exactly. And that has been going okay, but I kind of wish that there were more tools built in. Like right now, I can stop her from buying in-app purchases.
Right.
I can't give her a really friendly way of saying that the iPad only works from 6 p.m. till 8 p.m. And if she's been on for more than 30 minutes, it's going to slowly kind of fade to black and tell her to get up and do something else. And, of course, I'm in the room. I'm not trying to say that she has to be, you know, like my iPad has to do
maybe take responsibility, Dad.
Yeah, right.
No, well, but you need a helping hand. People who say that are often not parents, because if you're a parent, you know, like, it's much easier said than done.
Absolutely. And you know, the iPad, like I said, we are really slowly introducing this because we don't want it to become something that she's obsessed with. And even after a couple of weeks, she is already like, hey, where's the iPad? Can we play with the iPad? Hey, where's that iPad gone?
That's fun.
Yeah, yeah, because it is.
It just
exactly.
works.
I mean, it's like the size of a, you know, widescreen TV for her perspective.
It's
and
the size of, well, the iPad Pro is the size of the television I had growing up.
Yeah, right.
it's 13-inch. So like, it's pretty much it. Yeah. Mm,
but, you know, when I look at it anyway, like, take that outside. Like, take the parental stuff aside. I actually need my phone to look after me mm-hmm. and my time on my phone far more than I you know, I'm watching her use of technology. I'm more concerned with my own use of technology, and I know how bad I am at, like, disconnecting from mm-hmm. email, disconnecting from Slack, disconnecting from Twitter. And I'm just wondering, like, do you guys have any of those kind of any of those systems in place?
Raj?
Kind of, yeah. If I'm writing, I air gap myself. I literally cut off any network connection because I cannot concentrate on anything except my writing. I can't even have music unless it's sort of a classical something I can't tap my foot along
to. I'm the same way. Anything with words will pull me out.
Yeah. I really have to sort of think, cocoon myself in an environment that I cannot be distracted by things. And in my new, I just started a new role, a day job a few months ago, excuse me, and it's a lot of learning. You're all coming up to speed with new systems and tools and stuff like that. My multitasking has gone out the window. I really need to dedicate myself to being focused on the one particular task that I'm doing, completing that task, and then moving on to the next task. Whereas before I'm in roles that I've done for years and years and years, it was very much, I'll pick this off here and I'll do this here and stuff. It's a little different to setting a timer on my engagement with the technology, but I just can't do that in terms of my work responsibilities at the moment. But I really need to shut down some notifications. Notifications are the worst thing ever for me. I really struggle with the Slack ones. They've gone. I cannot have the Slack. Slack is only there when I need to be in Slack.
Yeah.
Email, same thing. I'll either shut them down or shove on that do not disturb and go from there. But in terms of the devices telling me it's time to stop, it's probably something I should have. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's something that I should be far more conscious of. I know that I spend all day at work with computers. I come home, I'm spending all night at work with computers. The only time that I'm not on the computer is when I'm setting up a video camera to review something for the computer. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is an ongoing cycle that never seems to end. That I'm sure my eyes are screaming for help or relief from. And even like the flux stuff, the blue screen, like the mm-hmm. it's nighttime, we're going to do. I hate that. Get it off.
Really?
Give me the color.
Oh,
give
I love the orange.
I can't because I'm looking at graphics or I might be doing some design bits. Well, like, and yeah, I'm like, okay, no, go away. So it's all turned off. I need to, really shut it.
I like to, and this is a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I like to congratulate myself on my ability to manage my devices. I'm very stingy with notifications. I'll often have people say, "Well, why don't you have your notifications on for Instagram, or why don't you read Facebook more often? Did you miss this and that?" And I'm like, I don't want to be disturbed, but I think I'm fooling myself by doing that, in that I've eliminated the one thing that I hear the complaints most about, like, oh, notifications, they kill me. I'm like, yeah, well, I keep those under control, but I'm still pulled back in. Mm-hmm. I'm still always like, well, I better check my email. Well, I better go back through Slack and see what people have said. And then that gets you stressed out because you run into a problem or a complaint or, you know, and in the job that I do, I run into complaints all the time because people can just email in whatever they're upset about, whether it's the change in time of the roundtable on Monday or the audio quality was off one day or something. And so I think it stresses me out more than I realize just because of the content of the communication,
oh, for sure.
Not so much the usage of it, which is why when we've talked about this before on the show, I'm like, we need more research. I'm not saying that what Google is doing is bad. I'm sure Apple's going to have more at WWDC about this. I have no doubts about it. But they're just trying things that sound like they would work, right? They sound like, oh, maybe that's a good idea. But then you hear Raj like, no, don't gray out my screen. It's like, okay, well, it's not going to work for everybody. What's the stuff that will actually help us deal with this? Because I have no doubt that this is a new challenge to humanity that we will figure out. But we're in the process of learning responsible use of these devices and connectivity.
Yeah, and I'm just really surprised, I guess, that Apple haven't taken the lead on this, because that seems to be the kind of area that they would do well in, that they tend to be the company that thinks about how the human interacts with the product,
yeah,
not
right.
just the product.
Where liberal arts meets
engineering. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And funnily enough, I think the people who have done it best were BlackBerry. A couple of years ago, they had a device that no one bought. So, you know, this is going to be new to everyone listening. But they had a device that you could set that after, you know, my work hours were 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. And at 6 p.m., all notifications from certain apps stop. And then they disappear. The apps actually disappear until the next day. And I kind of feel that's you almost need to go that far because, yeah, in terms of email, so basically I've got one set of notifications on my phone completely, and that is my wife can notify me. Mm-hmm. She can get through.
Yeah.
Everything else is silent. I don't even see the pop-ups. But even then, I still see every now and again I'll look down and I'll see that Outlook application icon, and I want to tap it.
Yeah, and it's got a number on it, right?
Well,
yeah.
No. I have no numbers on anything.
Oh, it's just
either.
The dot.
Yeah, yeah.
That's enough.
No, not even the dot.
You just see the icon. You don't even see a notification.
Yeah, I have no dots at all.
And you're just drawn to the siren song.
Exactly.
But might be in there. It's almost worse.
I know.
Who might have emailed me?
Yeah, yeah.
What if no one did?
I know. Well, that's the thing. It's just like, you know that, like, I've had to get into my head, and I think if you stop looking at it for a couple of weeks, it's like anything. You know, once you've stopped opening your email after a certain point, you realize that, like, the world didn't burn down around
yeah.
you, and you know, you get a little bit. I mean, obviously, some people have jobs where they can't, but I am lucky enough to have a job where I can most of the time. But yeah, you have to understand that, like you were saying, that it's actually the content that's going to either bum you out all night. Because, like, how often do you open up an email and it's like your boss saying, oh, a bit disappointed, and you know, well, it's Saturday. If I reply now, it's going to be weird, and I'm
right.
in a bad mood now, and so I probably should wait till I've calmed down,
yeah.
and then I'm just going to stew about it all night, and, you know, it's just ruined my weekend, and anyway. And then Monday, it's no big deal.
I think that's the bigger problem because, you know, muting notifications or turning the screen different colors or whatever – is certainly helpful in limiting our exposure to it. But like you said, just seeing that icon, right? And I do the same thing. I don't have notifications on for email at all from anyone. Mm. But I will constantly like, well, I better check. I better see what's in there. That's the thing we need help figuring out is like, how do you stop yourself from doing that? I'm pretty good in the evenings about saying, you know what, I'm just going to set that aside and I'm not going to look at it until tomorrow. But then sometimes I feel guilty, ridiculously, that like, oh, there was an email and I missed it, you know. And my wife, her job, they're 7 days a week, you know, they're always expecting a response because they have clients involved or whatever. And that culture needs to change.
Yeah. One of the greatest things, and Pete, you alluded to it with, you know, whether you can or you can't with your job. But one of the best things that I ever did was maybe 2 years ago, take my work email off my phone. I can no longer check my email for work unless I'm sitting at my work laptop or desktop or anything like that. Not only did I've extended that out to Slack as well, took Slack off completely off my phone, and the world changed. Like I no longer was I bummed out because I got an email about something that wasn't working, because it wasn't my job to fix it until I was at work. Yeah. So why should I be concerned or worrying or anxious or building up this anxiety when there's nothing I can do about it? I might not even be anywhere near a computer that I could do anything about it. So why throw that on myself? I've never looked back. I will never, ever, unless it's an absolute requirement of my job, have my work email or main communication that is supposed to be used at work on me all the time. And it just completely changed my world. The other thing that I did was force myself to read at night. Like I would set an 11 p.m. that I would normally go to bed around midnight. 11 p.m., shut everything down, go to bed and read a book.
Mm-hmm.
One great book that I read, Tom Merritt's
Pilot X. Stop. Thank you, though. Pilot X available in bookstores now.
I actually read that via audiobook, so I'm lying.
Sequel coming.
that again, I self-imposed that I would take myself away from the situation, even including playing video games, because it doesn't switch my brain off. It would actually stimulate my brain and keep me more awake. So it was very much a decision to take myself out of that situation, let my brain wind down and get into a sort of normal sleep pattern. And I would advocate that everyone do something like that. I think it's great for mindfulness. And I am 100% sure that Apple or Google or there was a big push for mindfulness and tech and health technology maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe when health care sort of started kicking around. And then it all just went... We got some treadmills that worked with health care. And, we can tell you if you're having a heart attack because you're wearing a watch now, maybe. But the actual mindfulness side of it was left to app developers, which I believe it was the ABC, again, the Australian Broadcast, did a recent piece on saying that 80 or 90% of mindfulness apps are complete and utter garbage.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like it's more. You need more than just, hey, we came up with an idea that sounds cool. Like you need to pair that, trying that with study to see like, well, what effect did it have? Did it actually help people? Let's, you know, and I think that's the job of academia to kind of jump in and cooperate with that. All right, we got a couple of bonus things here. First one is from me. I know both of you have preached the gospel of contactless payments, and I have intellectually realized, I have intellectually known that, yes, it's more common in Australia, but we do have it in the U.S., so I get how it works. Man, can I tell you, it is not the same at all. When I can go to a pie shop in Berrima, which is, you know, population 20, and pay with my iPhone and they don't even blink, they're like, yeah, I think that works. Like everywhere. It changed travel for me because I didn't have to think about, well, is this card going to work or do I need to get cash? Just always the better option is to use my phone to pay. And I maybe of all the transactions I've made over the past week and a half, two or three have been like, oh, yeah, that's not going to work. A couple of times it didn't work for other reasons involving the bank being weird, like, nah, we're not sure if that's you, but that's good. That's different. But most of the time it's just dead simple. Like, y'all were right.
Yeah, no, it is one of the weird little frustrations about going to the U.S. is you just forget that cash is still used in places, and it becomes – I mean, there are a couple of places that I visit regularly that – ask for cash if you're spending less than $5.
Sure.
That's it. That's as much as...
We were at the Victoria Market, which is this big, vast market, you know, full of vendors. The kind of place you wouldn't expect credit cards. Almost like everybody. Pikes. Yeah, yeah. Like a huge Pikes, yeah. Right? In Seattle, if you're not aware. So you wouldn't expect everybody to have credit cards, but they almost all did, except for the bratwurst place that I bought. And they're like, cash only. I'm like, ah... And I was 70 cents short. Mm. The guy was like, that's fine. So I went and I got 70 cents from my sister, who wasn't with me at the time, and I gave it to him, and he was appreciative. But it was the one exception that proved the rule, because I hadn't even thought about getting cash, because I hadn't needed it up until that point.
Yeah, when Fitbit released their latest watch, the Versa, it's an optional extra to get contactless payments in the US, and it just comes standard here because they know that could not sell it.
The stupid thing is we had tap cards and tried to be introduced, and they were the machines were put in, and it just didn't catch on, and I don't know why. And when Apple Pay and what's now Google Pay came out originally, they worked. And then companies would come in, like my local drugstore, and turn it off. Like, oh, we don't want it to work with Apple Pay. It's just ridiculous. So. The other bonus question comes from Doctor, who says, what do they think of all the foods generally thought of as Australian, such as Marmite and Vegemite? Why do they both have mite in the name?
Well, Marmite isn't Australian.
It's English, right?
It's English, yeah. And it was the original. So Vegemite, I researched this today. Vegemite came about because there was a Marmite shortage in Australia, and this guy created it, and its name was picked out of a hat.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. what do we think about it? I love it. It's grew up on the stuff.
I mean, but Vegemite is the one everyone knows because of the song, Men at Work song. That's how everyone learned about Vegemite. Yeah. But
it's essentially the remnants from the brewing process of beer.
Yeah.
So the yeast extract and so forth.
And I got criticized on Instagram for not having enough butter on my Turkish bread with my Vegemite.
Fair enough, too.
Well, yeah. It's a trick for new players that you use way less Vegemite than you expect.
That's the mistake Americans make. Yeah.
Because it is quite horrid. And it's been fun to teach my two-year-old that she has to eat Vegemite. Because it's fun watching someone try it for the first time and see just how disgusting it is. But it's like, look, you're Australian. You must eat this. So just battle on, huh?
Small amounts and then with butter. That's the key. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's also very good for mouth ulcers. So it's vitamin B extract. And if you have an ulcer, you can just dab. It'll sting like buggery. Well, there's an Australian colloquialism, buggery. But it will. It's actually good for them.
Yeah. Well, and then
I was told. Could be wives' tale.
Now, I don't know if these are pan-Australian or just the regions I was in, but schnitties.
Schnitties, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's another one.
That was another thing I've noticed. Australians tend to just like to take words and shorten them.
Or, if it's short, add an O on the end and make it longer. Like if your name's Dave, you'll be Dave-O.
Dave-O, okay. Yeah. St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Shop, we have those in the U.S., but they're Vinnies here.
Some Vinnies, yeah.
McDonald's, not short enough. Macca's,
yeah.
Yeah. So there's some other Australian trends that I've noticed and going around. Any other foods though? Pies. You guys have great pies.
Meat pies, yeah. There is a really good place in downtown LA called Aussie Bottom Pies or something like that. I stayed right next door to it. Yeah, they do Australian meat pies, lamingtons, pasties, which is like a, I don't know, empanada sort of style thing.
Yeah. We call them pasties, but yeah, same thing.
Yeah.
It sounds like a stripper, so it's probably better the way you said it.
Well, that's what I was going to say about schnitz. there's another colloquialism. They're actually really good. I wish I could remember. There's Aussie pies, if you look it up in downtown LA. They're actually quite good. That's Vegemite's the big one, really.
Yeah, I think so.
Tim Tams.
Oh, Tim Tams, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Vegemite and Tim Tams, that's our entire kind of gift to the world. That's where we ended.
And Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah, Wi-Fi.
Yeah. We developed Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi was developed in Australia. I don't think people know that. Yeah.
Yeah, the government-funded Australian Science Bureau.
That certainly is something people should realize.
Yeah, there's a whole TV campaign about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, if you're using Wi-Fi right now, thank an Australian. You'll find one eating Vegemite nearby at a pie shop. All right. Thank you guys for doing this. This was great fun. I know you had to rearrange your schedules to come down here, and I really appreciate it. So Raj, starting with you, where can people find what you're doing online?
You can find me at reckoner.com.au. We just launched a new podcast called I Don't Quite Know, which you will be hit up for shortly.
I will be honored.
it's a podcast where I talk to a bunch of people that I've met around the world about something that they're not quite known for. Oh. So the pilot episode was with an Australian video game presenter called Stephanie Ben-Dixon, and we talked about the anxiety of content creation and being a woman and being on TV and body image and all those types of things. So yeah, it's been really well received, and it's a part of our Patreon launch. So if you want to jump on that train, by all means, just go to reckoner.com.au/Patreon. Yeah, and that's where you find pretty much everything from me these days.
Excellent. Peter Wells, thank you as well. Where can folks find what you're doing?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, follow me on Twitter, Peter Wells. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes. And I'm actually launching something too, which is kind of cool. The Age has finally given me a column to talk about podcasting, which might be near and dear to the listener's heart. So, so that's going to be fun. I'm going to right now I've got a weekly tech column with them. From next week I'll have a weekly podcast column as well where I'll
Fantastic.
Be, trying to show some of the shows out there that I love and getting people interested in them. So I might actually have to talk to you as well about that.
I would also be interested in that myself. It's funny, at the reception for my nephew's wedding, which is the whole reason I came to Australia this time, I was getting hit up by a few people because they knew I was a podcaster for recommendations for other podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
They were always interested. They were nice enough to pretend to be interested in what mine was. But then they'd say, like, well, what else do you listen to? And I've been looking for good podcasts. It seems to be there's an appetite for people to get these kind of recommendations now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it says a lot that I'm replacing the weekly radio column. So.
Oh, really? Yeah, that is kind of a milestone, mm-hmm. isn't it? That's crazy. Also, huge thanks to James. You may, if you're watching the video, have seen him lurking in the background. James just had a baby and was not planning for that baby to have happened as soon as it was, but he stole away from Babyland to come downtown here in the CBD and set this up for us. And of course, he had to go back. But huge thanks to James and Culture Amp, the company that James works for, that is the space that we're at. Culture Amp does some really cool stuff. I don't mean to speak for them, but from what I can gather, their mission is to make startup culture better, to make it to improve it, to provide analytics. We always hear analytics like, oh, analytics are being used to manipulate you, and they're saying let's use analytics to make workplaces better for people. So that's a pretty cool mission. To be on and very generous to let us use this space. And I believe James is part of the Mac Admins podcast as well.
Yeah. So he's the producer of the Mac Admins podcast. It is a fine podcast. I am a Mac admin by trade, so I do listen to it every week. And if you do anything with Macs, more than about 50 of them in an organization, you should definitely be listening. It's a very good listen.
Take it from the Ages podcast recommendation columnist, Mac Admins.
I have many hats.
Podcast.macadmins.org. Hey, folks, if you'd like more of these roundtable shows, we usually do them, the normal way out of the studio in Los Angeles, but we did have an all-Canadian episode. We've had an all-Australian episode. We had an all-space episode. We like to pull them around themes and look at all these various ways of looking at technology to change the perspective. And we want to do that more often. Right now we're doing it once a month, but if we can get $2,000 more in our Patreon, we can do them more often. We can do at least twice a month. So think about upping your pledge. There's some perks to that if you haven't already. And everybody who does support us, thank you very much at patreon.com/DTNS. Our email address is feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. We're live Monday through Friday, usually at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC at alphageekradio.com and diamondclub.tv. And our website is dailytechnewsshow.com. In a few short hours, Sarah and Roger will be back with Patrick Beja. We'll talk to you then.
show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit.
From a local business to a global corporation.
Partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.